This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Most Mondays, we are joined by Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and BestBunnyMoves.com. Elise is looking at kind of an overview of the markets. What have you got for us today, Elise?
Well, John, it's sort of interesting. You know, we just heard that we're setting yet another record today, unbelievably enough, with the Dow. And, you know, I just wanted to point out, you know, while we are in this third year of a bull market, it seems to be just powering ahead, you know, crazy. So the Dow today up another 192 points. If you look at it for year to date, it's up over 14%. This is really just sort of a remarkable thing that I'm not sure people are just, you know, you don't look at the market typically. We look at it day to day, even sometimes minute to minute. But most people, for them, the market is all about what's going on in their 401ks. And if your 401k is invested in the stocks that mirror the Dow Jones, or if you're invested in an S&P 500 account, you may notice that it's up almost 23% just year to date. That's how much the S&P 500 is up, about 22.81% as of this minute. You know, just from a year ago, it's up 35%. And from the beginning of this sort of bull run, from that sort of dip that we had in 2022, it's up, I don't know, over 60%. And so when you look at this and you look at your own wealth, and you should feel okay about it. This is the stuff that's going to power people into retirement. So it's just worth sort of taking that 30,000 foot view for, you know, once in a while.
Well, so if the Dow is up 14%, and by the way, at this very moment, it's at 43,057.
Right.
Unbelievable. And that's only up 13.5%. The S&P is up almost double that at 23%, and the NASDAQ for the year to date is up 24+. So
right. So
we all cheer on the Dow, and we all know it's an imperfect sort of reflection of how even Wall Street is doing, but the S&P and NASDAQ, the broader spectrum, certainly the S&P, are doing even better, considerably so.
Yeah, and you're even at the Russell 2000, which is really smaller companies, you know, over the course of a year, that's up over 30%. And while we haven't quite topped the highs from last July, right, we're very close. We're, you know, within spitting distance of that as well. And so they've beaten their way back, you know, all the way to the top. So what does that tell you? That tells you that across the board, large companies, small companies, global companies, tech companies, obviously powering a lot of this. But if you're invested in the economic indices, right, the S&P 500, or even if you went with a tech first or a growth mutual fund, you've done very well. And it's worth just showing people, you know, how you know, take a step back and take a look and see where you are compared to a year ago or 5 years ago. And I'm betting that if you've got some investments in the stock market, most people have it through their 401k, you're doing okay right now.
What's Terry Savage say? You don't have to beat the market, just be the market. And for the year to date, boy, that sure is the case. So when somebody tells you the economy is doing terribly, you can remember this. One of the problems with that, though, is that, you know, everything is personal and local. And if your day-to-day costs are still high, I don't know how much of a consolation this is, but we're told it's true that there will be a lag perhaps between some of these markets improving and you actually seeing an improvement in your pocketbook, either because you're making more money or costs moderate. Obviously, those things are happening. But when and how much may be the question you are asking. But in the meantime, the economy is doing well. You just cannot factually argue that. Elise Glink's joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch from ThinkGlink.com, ThinkGlink Media, and Best Money Moves. Elise, what has the impact of the hurricanes been?
Today with our director of sales, head of sales for Best Money Moves. He's based in Fort Myers, where they just got the outer bands of the storm. And their lights are flickering today as they are trying, working hard. 50,000 people in the electrical repair business have gone down there to begin to reconnect the grid. And what it makes you realize is just how massive this hurricane was right on top of Helene, which was even bigger. And the initial damage estimates are so far below where now things seem to be coming into relief, as you see what has really been going on the last few weeks. They're now expecting damages for Helene, Hurricane Helene, to be $250 billion, somewhere around that number. And Milton, the early estimate of $50 to $60 billion, the latest numbers that I'm seeing, even over the last couple of hours, are showing that to be multiples of that. And there's just some significant amount of damage that people are now starting to realize as they go through. These are incredible, incredible numbers, John.
No kidding. I'm frankly shocked that they're that high. I knew this was supposed to be, both of them, among the most expensive natural disasters ever in America, certainly this year, one, two in the same sort of area. So what's the economic impact then?
Well, you know, you consider the damage, just it's funny when you start to look at the details, right? These big numbers are almost so big, you can't get your head around it. I mean, we're talking about just for two hurricanes, maybe $500 billion. I mean, that's some real number. And you think, well, how does that actually boil down? Well, in for Milton last week, apparently it hit the orange producing industry really hard. So all of those oranges that were just getting ripe were about to be, they were going to start picking them. It devastated grove after grove. I mean, we're talking about thousands of acres of oranges. So you can just imagine, you know, the economic impact of that. Up in North Carolina, in Asheville, this is the Q4, and really what we're talking about is right now through November, the leaf changing season. And typically this Q4 for Asheville and the whole area, it sees 14 million people come through to do some leaf peeping. It's a very beautiful, beautiful area of the country. And that generates about $3 billion of economic impact for the 90-plus hotels and Airbnbs and all of that. And so it made me start to think about, well, we know what the destructive capability looks like. What happens on the flip side when you start to generate repairs, and who pays for all of that? And so the broader impact is so interesting because the repairs from one hurricane can indirectly support almost 250,000 jobs, generate $17 billion in labor income, and contribute over $30 billion to GDP, and has a total output of about $62 billion. So every dollar that you spend fixing up after a hurricane, right, generates $1.72 for the economy. So, and that's distributed pretty broadly. So it's kind of interesting. It's like terrible impact on the individual level because people just get wiped out, businesses get wiped out, but then the rebuilding starts to help with, you know, bringing more money into an area.
I guess if you're in construction, if you're just think about all of the products and services that are going to be needed in several states comprehensively, that's good business for the people that are in those businesses, right?
It is. I mean, maintenance and repair services, roofing, for example, retail, anything related to housing, petroleum refinery, banking. Those kinds of service, it's a wide service area. But also, if you think about hospitality is big, restaurants that get wiped out, but new ones have to open up. In fact, an example of this is there are about, according to Explore Asheville, which is a kind of a local tourism site, there are about 90 hotels in that area. And almost all of them have reopened. And they're housing people who are part of the recovery effort, right? Yeah. The recovery and the rebuilding. So those hotels are doing okay at the moment. They had a couple of weeks where, you know, they're probably insured for those losses. But the people who are servicing the hotel, they're having to find new jobs because those people are dealing with maybe not having houses right now. And they've got other bigger issues. And so the hotels are open, but they need help to hire people to service them for those who, you know, employees who didn't come back. So it's kind of interesting at this, you know, push-pull, right? In our economy, one side typically wins, right? One side is losing, and then you get this rebuilding and they rebuild again. It's kind of everybody, you know, the stock market, which we were just talking about, I've got some stocks to sell. Somebody sells, somebody buys. Somebody's typically on the win side of that transaction and the lose side, and rarely do you get a win-win. The hurricanes are kind of a worst-case scenario like that. And I want to be, you know, particularly sensitive to those people who have been wiped out. I'm hearing this morning that there is just a whole spate in Sarasota, Florida, of 5, 10, 15, and $20 million houses that are completely wiped out. They're gone. And so you can imagine, even when somebody can have that expense of a house, it's not an inexpensive thing to rebuild.
I'm thinking of the first call that Bob Surratt took this morning a little after 6 a.m. He gives an American Weathermaker's desktop calendar or weather station to the first person that calls. And the first guy that called in was from Northern Illinois, and he was working with Duke Energy in Florida. He was calling from Florida, and he's up there trying to get the electrical lines back up. They had 3 million people without power. He said, well, today we're at, I think, was it 40 or 400,000 still without power. That guy is staying in a hotel. Somebody's paying his bills, and it's good for him and his business. And it's obviously very bad for the other people. It's, as Elise Glink said, a push-pull. It's also 1227. Elise, let's talk next Monday, okay?
Sounds good, John. Thank you.
She's the owner of Think Glink Media. Best Money Moves. You can find her stuff at thinkglink.com. John Williams on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Elise Glink a little while ago talking about the need to redevelop parts of Florida and the Carolinas because of the storms. Stephen Fleur is here to talk about a different kind of development. He's a senior vice president of development for Uniball Rodamco Westfield. I hope I said all of that right. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
You did. Yeah, thanks for having me back, John. Doing great.
Let's talk a little bit about Westfield Old Orchard. What's going on there?
Yeah, so last Tuesday, the Village of Skokie took the next step on our approval path for our two phases of redevelopment at the property, where we take down some existing empty retail space and redevelop the north end of the property there with mixed-use development.
So a mixture of residential. Keep going.
Yeah, so a mixture of residential with new retail, predominantly food and beverage in the podiums in the first phase, and then in the second phase, additional residential and also the potential for a hotel.
Let's just talk a little bit about what that timeline is then. So first, the restaurant and retail will go up?
Yeah, so the first phase really is we take down the old Bloomingdale's box. If you recall, we relocated them into a smaller new format on the other side of the center, take down some of the adjacent retail. And then in that first phase, we built about 400 apartments, and then it's about 16,000 square feet of retail in the podium. And then importantly, as part of that first phase, really is the whole community creation piece, where we develop a half-acre town green, you know, kind of quasi-community park space that we can bring more programming to.
Is this sort of like Burr Ridge or Carmel, Indiana? I was there the other day, and it's a developed town. Almost everything's going up at the same time. Do you know what I'm talking about, and can you kind of give us some perspective on that?
Sure. Yeah, I do know what you're talking about, and it is fairly similar in look. You know, working on these retail flagship assets that are really strong retail centers to begin with, it's a little bit like doing surgery on a patient that's wide awake. So we're really careful on how we execute to ensure that the rest of the patient is in really good shape. In this case, we want to keep the ball flowing. The location for this really lends itself to that, so we can execute on these two phases with pretty minimal interruption to the mall itself, while we obviously continue to improve the site.
We're talking about Westfield's Old Orchard Mall and then this development that's going up around it. What's the price point, square footage, amenities? Describe the apartments that would be going in there.
Sure. So we have a mixture of luxury apartment living that's coming in, you know, anything from studios, ones and twos, with and without dens. We also have a maisonette offer, which essentially is like a townhome type of offer. So it's a two-story offer where there's a limited number of those on the site. The amenities themselves are really in this kind of jewel box. It sits up on the third floor that the outdoor space with the pool overlooks the town green. All the fitness and assembly rooms, they all overlook the town green. And when you look in our plans, or you'll see that with the future phases, it's the same with the hotel and the second phase residential, that we really want everybody, you know, visibly connected and quote unquote kind of part of the same space. You know, everybody enjoys that outdoor activity at Old Orchard like it is today. Mm-hmm. This really kind of takes it to the next level. And then the apartments themselves, you know, they're really, you know, in this scheme, you know, we're always looking for the top amenities that are available. What that means changes every single year in the multifamily business. So it's the constant evolution of what we're looking at, what's going to go in there.
And it's your estimation that people will want to live near a shopping center? They want to be part of a complex like that?
Yeah, we believe that the mall as an amenity is a big added benefit. Old Orchard is not the only place we're doing this. We're doing this with our regional flagships around the country. In New Jersey, we're on the same path, a little bit ahead, actually. And we are finding, you know, tremendous interest in this type of environment where people can come and park their car and come downstairs and enjoy the mall as amenity.
Does that represent a change in thinking about shopping centers or malls?
You know, it does a little bit. You know, I do think that, you know, we have all been on this journey of finding the right size when it comes to the right size amount of retail at these centers. This is definitely not a dead mall discussion for us. These are, you know, regional flagship retail assets for us, where we're winning the retail in the North Shore. So we have constant demand for our retail space. We're always going to keep reinventing that. But in that scenario, we have some excess space. For instance, we take a 200,000 square foot Bloomingdale's, we relocate them into 50,000 square feet where they're doing more sales than they did in their big box. And then we can repurpose that physical real estate and add this type of density where we continue to add new uses to the property that we believe are complementary to that shopping experience.
How important are those flagships, and what are some of the ones that are going to stay there or be new there?
Yes. So, you know, flagships, if you're talking specifically at Old Orchard, you know, we do continue to get flagship retail presence at the site. You know, the latest, for instance, is, you know, we bought the former Lord & Taylor box some years ago. We're finishing up that redevelopment right now where we have put in a flagship Zara, for instance, where they were already in sight in a smaller presence and decided to make Westfield Old Orchard the flagship retail presence for them on the North Shore. Same for Pottery Barn. They now have their flagship presence there. Our house just opened, and then we'll be bringing in Putt Shack as the entertainment experience, which will open early next year.
Yeah.
But that flagship presence at the site is very important to our type of retail.
You know, it's interesting. Obviously, you're having some success, and you're putting your money where your mouth is on these sort of developments. And yet, I would imagine the Water Tower Place is a different animal entirely. But just as it's down the street from me, that is a challenged space. And I wonder how you know that this concept or these developments are going to be so successful.
Yeah, it is a combination. It's a great question, and it's a combination of factors. The United States is over-retailed from a regional shopping center perspective. Everyone has known this. The evolution of the industry has been on this course for some time. It was admittedly accelerated during COVID for sure. And that accelerated the end of some centers and the strengthening of others, where retailers simply were making choices of where they wanted to put fewer but better stores. Our centers that we have historically been some of the best situated, some of the best real estate.
Yeah.
And we have consistently reinvested over time as well, which makes a big difference in attracting your retailer.
Is location a key?
Absolutely. That is real estate 101.
One last question. Stephen Fleur is on the line, Senior Vice President, Development for Uniball Redamco Westfield. Interest rates may be coming down. How impactful is that for your business?
Absolutely helpful in the development world. Not just for my piece of the business, but for everyone in the development world. With the interest rates coming down, it does make projects more accessible, more financeable, and deepens the pool of interest from the finance community in our projects. So we definitely look forward to seeing those interest rates come down.
Right. I mean, that might mean lower rental payments for the apartment dwellers and lower the expenses for you or anybody doing construction on a project like this, right?
That's right. It does have a ripple-on effect all the way through the chain.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Stephen. Let's stay in touch. Good luck. Congratulations. And keep us posted.
We definitely will. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, that's Stephen Fluor, Senior Vice President, Development, Uniball-Radamco Westfield, talking about the project at Old Orchard. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based True Value has filed for bankruptcy. The filing comes as the company tries to sell itself, with rival Do It Best leading the bidding. Do It Best has offered $153 million in cash to purchase True Value and says it will support True Value during the sale process. True Value serves a network of 4,500 independently owned and operated retailers. It was founded in 1948. It blames inflation for limiting consumer spending and curtailing home improvement projects. Do It Best is headquartered in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and serves thousands of member retailers. We're learning more about plans for the new Gibson's location in Chicago. Cranes reports the newest offering at 919 West Fulton will feature two concepts, including a tavern, burger, steak place, plus a high-end supper club. The launch date is currently set for July 2026. The new restaurant will be on the ground floor of the 11-story office building near Fulton and Sangamon. This will be the 15th Gibson's location. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, here's an update. Actually, we call it the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And we are about to learn a word in Swahili.
Mafsi.
What that is, after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, this was the first weekend in business for a new restaurant on the south side, Nafsi.
Yeah, well, so the name is derived from a Swahili connotation of soul, as to our impression of being the soul of Chicago.
That is Donnell Rigby, who describes himself as a father, a community leader, and a serial entrepreneur. And a few days ago, he opened his new restaurant, Nafsi 1916.
Inside the Chicago Cultural Center, South Shore Cultural Center.
Nafsi is spelled N-A-F-S-I, and the 1916 is a tribute to the year the building it's in was rebuilt into a beautiful Mediterranean Revival palace it remains today. But up until the mid-1970s, Donnell was not even allowed to set foot on the grounds.
It was a country club, a private country club.
Meaning no blacks, no Jews, and no Italians for many years either. But now,
we're the first African-American restaurant to be in the building ever.
How does that make you feel?
It gives me a sense of profound obligation. My father was a pastor. He's always taught me that as a black man, I have an obligation to not only myself, but to my family and my community.
And what's the community going to see when it goes into Nafsi 1916?
Man, it's a beautiful, well-lit, well-decorated space, Steve.
It has a year-round outdoor patio with a bar right on the lake. And the food, with executive chef Don D. Robinson in charge,
that kid knows his way around the kitchen,
is described as soul food with a twist.
Not exactly soul food, but it's an elevated, soulful experience.
Got it. But do you have collard greens?
We have wilted kale greens.
That'll make Dave Ennett happy for sure.
And they're great, Steve. You'll love them.
Nafsi 1916, rewriting history as the first black-owned restaurant in a grand old historic building with a racist past. It's easy to find.
7059 South on South Shore Drive.
On the food calendar, it's National Dessert Day and National Real Sugar Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
The Wintrust Business Lunch, and a business we like to check in on once in a while, is Christiana Trapani's Door County Candle Company in Door County, Wisconsin. Christiana, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me today.
This is a business show. The idea of businesses is to make a lot of money and then keep the money. You keep giving it away, Christiana.
We do. We definitely do. We've already had a lot of Support a Cause candles, and the recent one is another one that we're really, really excited about.
Support a Cause candles, made first famous maybe when the war erupted in Ukraine. What's the latest cause you're donating proceeds to?
So we are donating our proceeds from our beachside candle to Hurricane Helene and Milton Relief currently.
Is this a specific candle again? Tell me how this works.
Yes, so it is our beachside candle, the 16-ounce size, and it's actually the same candle that we used when Hurricane Ian hit, and we raised $14,000 with that candle a few years ago. And the scent is kind of like it smells like sunscreen in a beach day. So we used that one a few years ago, and we brought it back for this hurricane relief.
So are you doing Helene and Milton, or how are you doing that?
Yeah, so it started with Helene, and then we added Milton to it. A lot of customers were calling and asking if it was going to support both, and we immediately made that edit to it when Milton hit.
So do you give the money to the Red Cross?
Yes, and actually one of our employees, she's actually a volunteer with the Red Cross. She is one of the nurses, and she was actually in Tampa the night Milton hit, and she was one of the only nurses that were there. Previously, she was helping with search and rescue for Hurricane Helene, so she's been giving us a lot of updates and just telling us how much the money we're raising really is helping and making an impact.
My. Is it a specific candle, or is it any of the products?
Yes, good question. So it is just our 16-ounce beachside Hurricane Helene and Milton relief candle. So just that one size. In a little over a week, we've already raised $7,000 and counting.
Hmm. Your business must be pretty robust. It's clear that your heart is in a good place, but to do that much that quickly, you must just have a lot of volume coming into your site anyway, huh?
Yeah. It's funny, when we launch these new candles, we're typically not prepared because we often run out of fragrance, or we run out of something, and because you can never prepare for a disaster, obviously. And so right now we brought in a number of volunteers who wanted to come back and help. So they're helping us wick our jars and pack our boxes and get orders out, which is really incredible. It's the same volunteers who helped us with Ukraine, and they're coming back to help us with this Support a Cause candle.
You raised $1 million for charities to help the people of Ukraine. How many people do you employ?
We have, I think we have 9 employees. We only have three full-timers, including me, and then the rest are part-time. And then we have, like I said, volunteers. My husband's a volunteer. My mom's a volunteer. And then we have a handful of other volunteers. So we're a pretty small team.
How many candles do you move in a week, year, month, whatever?
You know, it really varies. You know, this, with the hurricane candle, we currently have a few hundred orders that are in the queue that we're actively shipping. We've been making a few hundred candles a day. So in the height of Ukraine, we were able to make 1,200 candles a day, which was definitely our peak. That was peak production. So we learned a lot from that, which has helped us to improve our speed for sure.
If you want a nice candle and you want the proceeds to go to a good cause, it's the Door County Candle Company in Door County, Wisconsin. DoorCountyCandle.com. Our best to your family. Keep doing what you're doing up there.
Thank you so much.
Christiana Trapani is the owner at DoorCountyCandle.com.